the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today we're going to be talking about what a lot of America is talking about, and that is the real threat to marriage. Because there are some people out there who are saying, look, conservative Christians seem to be all up in arms over same-sex marriage, but where's the concern about divorce? I'm going to argue, number one, that that is a false accusation. Because we talk about divorce regularly. I write about it. But today we're going to be talking about it. And we're going to use two illustrations of the problem that does lead to the point that some question our credibility on this issue. That will come up in just a few minutes. First, a review of some issues in the news. Big issue in the news is, of course, the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And by any measure, that is a big step forward for the war on terror. It is unusual, isn't it, that here we're talking about what is packaged as good news, the killing of one man that is received as good news. How can that be good news? It's good news because in a world where good and evil are not merely subjective apprehensions, but they are objective realities when it comes to those who will do such evil things, it is a net good thing that this man is no longer alive to do his evil. And it is important that we understand why it is a net good thing that this man is no longer to do evil. There can be no rejoicing in the killing of any human being. But there are times when lethal force has to be used in order to protect human life. This is a man who single-handedly has orchestrated and organized the killing of thousands of persons, maybe more, but at least it's safe to say thousands. It was he who was behind the beheading of Nicholas Berg. It was he who was behind so many of the car bombings and the other things that have led to terrorist killings in Iraq and beyond. This is one reminder to us that in this fallen world, at times, lethal force is necessary. But we had better, as Christians, think very carefully about how we need to respond to this. It is perhaps understood as a step towards progress in Iraq. But it is at a very high cost. We as Christians can never ignore the moral complexity involved in the use of lethal force. It is at its very most necessary, a lamentable necessity. But both of those words are really important. It is a necessity. Let's listen to British Prime Minister Tony Blair as he spoke about this issue.
The death of al-Zarqawi is a strike against al-Qaeda in Iraq, and therefore a strike against al-Qaeda everywhere. But we should have no illusions. We know that they will continue to kill. We know there are many, many obstacles to overcome. But they also know that our determination to defeat them is total.
That British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking after the announcement that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had been killed due to the fact that one of his own followers evidently helped American and allied forces to know where he was, and in a targeted strike in a supposed safe house, this was carried out. There are all kinds of complexities about this. One of them, I think, is the showing of the body of this man. There could be something macabre, deeply evil, and almost circus-like in its atrocity in showing this kind of photograph. But those who are doing it say it's necessary in order that this be a proved fact, and that the followers of al-Qaeda in Iraq would know indeed that al-Zarqawi is dead. There are other issues in the news, of course. One very frightening story also related to death comes out of the United Kingdom, where in Great Britain there is now a call by some for involuntary euthanasia. Now, time and time again, we are told that we are to avoid slippery slope arguments. And you know, there is a danger in relying upon slippery slope arguments for the major force of making an argument against or for something. For instance, I would argue against euthanasia in any form. And I would simply point out that the slippery slope actually does apply. In other words, it's not just that the slope leads to a supposedly inevitable conclusion. the point is, at the very top of the slope, so to speak, you are already in an immoral position. Now, that's what we have to make clear. In other words, we must oppose all forms of euthanasia. But when you're talking about different forms of euthanasia, you start out with what is called passive and voluntary euthanasia, the withholding of some kind of medical service or treatment that is done at the insistence or the instigation of the patient. And then you get to the most morally complex, the most evil form of euthanasia, the part that is most quintessentially in alignment with the culture of death, and that is active involuntary euthanasia, when persons are actively put to death against their will, without their consent. Now, that's how the slope works. You start out with people saying, look, we can somehow manage this passive voluntary euthanasia. Before long, you have inevitably active involuntary euthanasia. And that's just the way it works. The problem with this slope is that it really is slippery. You really can't negotiate once you give away the sanctity of human life at the very top of the slope. The evidence for that right now is coming from Emeritus Professor Lynn Doyle in an article that was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicine in Great Britain. The journal is entitled Clinical Ethics. Professor Doyle says, and I quote, when doctors withdraw life-sustaining treatment such as feeding tubes from severely incompetent patients, it should be morally recognized for what it is, euthanasia, where death is foreseen with certainty. Doctors may not want to admit this and couch their decision in terms such as alleviating suffering, but withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment from severely incompetent patients is morally equivalent to active euthanasia. Now, Professor Doyle goes on, and now reading from The Guardian, also a paper from Great Britain, he suggests that refusing this is, quote, the very worst form of medical paternalism. He argues that doctors are already effectively practicing euthanasia on patients who have no consciousness beyond the capacity to suffer pain. And Professor Doyle says this should extend to those patients who can no longer speak for themselves. He claims not to be the only medical professional to hold this view. In the article, he says withdrawing life-saving treatment from severely incompetent patients is believed to be morally appropriate because it constitutes doing nothing. But he wants to push it further. He wants to move from passive euthanasia to active euthanasia. So here you're not even talking about some point along the slope. You're talking about jumping from the top to the bottom in one proposal. Now, what's really interesting is that in Great Britain, euthanasia is being debated in terms of national policy. Lord Jaffe has proposed a voluntary euthanasia bill, which is making its way through the parliament there in Great Britain. By the way, the Church of England has come out steadfastly against that bill. And that is perhaps even a rare moment of, I think, some moral clarity out of the Church of England. And we'll see if they can hold it or not. Why would I say that's rare clarity out of the Church of England? It's because I hold in my hands a report indicating that the Anglican Bishop of Oxford, the Right Reverend Richard Harries, has now suggested in an article that a careful reading of the Bible reveals scriptural support. You hear that word? Support for homosexual unions. Concerning those unions, this in the report from the Sunday Telegraph of London and National Review magazine, the bishop remarked in an interview that, quote, they are congruous with the deepest biblical truths about faithfulness and stability, that is, homosexual unions. All this in the context of a different bishop's making waves on a pastoral visit to Kenya. And that did make a lot of waves, where an Anglican bishop was refused hospitality in Africa because of his pro-homosexual views. It is really interesting. What we're seeing here, of course, is the mainline Protestant denominations in the United States and elsewhere being torn apart on the issue of homosexuality. And it's not over. And, of course, we'll be talking about that in a different context in the main part of our program today. What about addiction? Theodore Dalrymple, who, by the way, is a psychiatrist and is a skilled writer, he argues in an article published this week in the Wall Street Journal that the idea of addiction is really more or less a false idea. He traces it back to 1822 when a man by the name of Thomas De Quincey claimed that his use of opium was due to a physical addiction. Let me read from Dr. Dalrymple. He says this, "This romantic nonsense has been accepted wholesale by doctors and literateurs, that is, writers, for nearly two centuries. It has given rise to an orthodoxy about opiate addiction, including heroin addiction, that the general public likewise takes for granted. That is, a person takes a little of the drug and is hooked. The drug renders him incapable of work, but since withdrawal from the drug is such a terrible experience, and since the drug is expensive, the addict is virtually forced into criminal activity to fund his habit. He cannot abandon the habit except under medical supervision, often by means of a substitute drug. Now, Dr. Dalrymple says, in each and every particular, this picture is not only mistaken, but obviously mistaken. He says this, it actually takes some effort to addict oneself to opiates. He ties that to other drugs and supposedly addictive substances as well, but it's fascinating to have a member of the medical community, a psychiatrist of recognized rank and esteem, who comes out and says, look, this whole idea of blaming everything on an addiction is itself a convenient illusion. It just isn't so. One has to actually work hard, he says, to develop this kind of what is called an addiction. What are we addicted to, after all? The universal human addiction is to sin. And that explains a whole lot. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I have been listening to so much of the media coverage about the Senate vote this week on the Marriage Protection Amendment, and one thing has come up again and again from people who largely condescendingly and often even sarcastically try to dismiss the Marriage Protection Amendment by saying, look, the real threat to marriage is divorce. Now, number one, while we're talking about the real threat to marriage, it's not one thing, unless you're just going to categorize it as the entire culture that is growing increasingly hostile to marriage as an ideal. But when we're talking about marriages that fail and marriages that break up, there's no doubt that divorce is the cause of the greatest marital breakup, as that's by definition, and has led to certainly the crumbling of the very foundation of marriage in a way that same-sex marriage has not yet. But it is simply a false dichotomy to say the threat is A rather than B. But behind the accusation coming from some on the secular left is, look, you Christians, conservative Christians, you say there's a big problem with same-sex marriage, but if you were really serious about marriage, you would have to take divorce more seriously. Now, this gets down to the issue of integrity and credibility. It also gets down, of course, to the question of divorce. Now, when it comes to the credibility issue, I have to say that on this program, we talk about divorce very candidly in a biblical perspective. For years, I have written about this. It is indeed a scandal. And I have to agree with many of these critics that evangelicals are taking it far too lightly. Far too lightly. Christians are largely accommodating themselves to the culture of divorce. We're even buying in as a movement of millions and millions of persons who claim the name of Christ, buying into what Barbara Defoe Whitehead calls expressive divorce, a no-fault divorce. This is divorce that is a growth experience. There are evangelical testimonies out there, people talking about how they grew through their divorce and how this was a good experience. They were liberated by their divorce. Let me just tell you that this is a credibility issue that is really going to hurt. And I also want to suggest to you there are a lot of radio programs that wouldn't dare touch this. There are a lot of churches that do not touch it, and I think that itself is a lack of credibility, a lack of integrity, and I think it is a very dangerous precedent. And when the secular world begins looking at us and saying, look, you're accommodating yourselves to divorce, what right do you have to jump on the issue of same-sex marriage? We have to admit they've got an argument there. That doesn't mean it's an argument for same-sex marriage. It's an argument for a recovery of theological and biblical sanity among evangelicals. Well, let me just share with you a couple of things here. By the way, some statistics sometimes help to lay this out. The Center for Health Statistics in the U.S. indicates, that's the National Center for Health Statistics, indicates that back in 2005, in a 10-month period, there were about 1.8 million marriages, that is couples, not 1.8 million people. That would be, you know, 3.6 million people, 1.8 million couples. But during the same period, right at 800,000 couples divorced. That's a divorce rate in this country of between 35 and 45%, which is holding pretty constant. That is a scandal. And, of course, facilitating that scandal is the rise of what is called no-fault divorce laws, which basically mean it's very easy to get out, even if only one member of the marriage wants to get out, one spouse, the courts facilitate this. And people now are just moving in and out of marriages with a very fast pace. Let me share something with you here. I wrote about this just in the last 24 hours at my blog at albertmueller.com because this is one of those stories that just hits you between the eyes. And I'm just going to ask you to listen for a moment as I tell you a story. And then I'm going to tell you a second one. And if this doesn't give us something to talk about, there's something wrong with us. First story. The Sacramento Bee, published Saturday, June the 3rd. I'm just going to read you the opening of the story. He is an unlikely troublemaker. With a voice for radio and eyes that brighten when talking about Scripture, the Reverend Barry Beisner seems as if he should be leading Sunday school worship, Sunday morning worship service, not making waves within the church. But he is. An Episcopal priest who has served the Sacramento area for 17 years, Beisner has been married 3 times, something many in the diocese have known for years. Now, clergy and lay leaders have elected Beisner Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Northern California. Beisner's election must be approved at a national meeting of church leaders that begins June 13. If that approval is given, many believe Beisner will be the first bishop in the church to have been divorced twice and married 3 times. The story goes on. I just have to scratch my head. Number one, just listen to how that part I read ended. It says, many believe Beisner will be the first bishop in the church to have been divorced twice and married 3 times. Well, for crying out loud, you mean you wouldn't even know that? Isn't that something you could find out pretty fast? In other words, is this really notorious at all? Let's remember that in the Bible, we have the presentation of marriage as one of the central displays of the glory of God, one of God's most perfect and wonderful gifts to his human children. He has given us marriage where we find the covenant faithfulness between the husband and the wife to mirror the faithfulness which is to exist between God and his people. And then in the New Testament, we have the relationship between Christ and the church, pictured in terms, again, of marriage, the bridegroom and the bride. We are pointed to the end of all things and the perfection of God's plan. And how is it described? As the marriage supper of the Lamb. Marriage is presented as one of those institutions God has created that is universal in its scope. It's a part of creation. And universal in its obligation, and it is for our good, for our health, for our happiness, and for our holiness. When we accept divorce, we simply bring into marriage a death pill that undermines the very integrity of the institution. Now, in this fallen world, we know that bad things do happen. After all, Christians are the people who cannot, or at least should not, be surprised by sin. But we also know that even as bad things happen and we have to deal with that, what you have in a situation like this is something that is so out of control, it's even hard to imagine. You have an Episcopal priest who is on his 3rd wife. That would be notorious enough. By the way, I was on an airplane a few years ago with a pastor of another denomination who was also on his 3rd wife. And he said to me, I guess in your denomination, that wouldn't be acceptable. And I said, well, we wouldn't even know about it. Because the first divorce would have been unacceptable. It takes a real stretch of the imagination to get to this. And if 3, why not 4? Why not 5? Now, this is leading to some controversy in the church. But here again, we're talking about the Episcopal Diocese of Northern California. And here's just a guess. That's probably a fairly liberal diocese. And it's easy for evangelicals to look at that and say, well, hey, that's not our story. But I think it is. I think it is. Because in the April edition of GQ magazine, there is an article by Walter Kern, kind of the wacko novelist of some very eccentric books, on the abstinence movement among evangelicals. And in this article, he looks at Stephen Arterburn, the co-author of a very well-known series of books, Every Man's Battle, Every Young Man's Battle, an entire industry of every person's battle on the issue of lust. And it turns out that Walter Kern is pretty pleased with what he finds in Stephen Arterburn, because this man, who's writing to thousands and thousands of young evangelicals about sex, is also on his 3rd wife. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that when we come back. The question is whether we as evangelicals really believe that marriage is what we say it is, the union of one man and one woman for a lifetime. Because the credibility of our argument for marriage is being undermined by the fact that it seems that we're allowing an exception for divorce when others are demanding an exception for same-sex marriage. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We were just talking about the issue of divorce and Christian credibility on the question of marriage. I had mentioned going into this the story of the newly elected bishop of the Episcopal Church in the Diocese of Northern California. His name is Barry Beisner, and what makes this story notorious is that he is on his third wife. And evidently there's some Episcopalians who think that it just might not be a good idea to elect a man as bishop who's on his third wife. Now, what in the world happened to 1 Timothy 3, where Paul says that the teaching elder, the pastor, the one who holds spiritual leadership, is to be the husband of one wife? Are we supposed to say that it's one wife at a time, up to whatever number you can divorce and remarry? Obviously, that can't work. That cannot work. Also, beyond a man of good repute, you know, this by its very nature, still, I hope and pray, calls out for some scandal. But as I said, it's one thing to look at the Episcopal Diocese of Northern California, which I just am going to be bold to say, I assume it's just a little bit on the left side, probably. But when it comes to evangelicals, we think we're probably in better order. I'm mentioning the April 2005 story in GQ magazine. It attracted attention because in the cover it said the new Christian sex craze, which turns out to be abstinence, and a part of the focus on this is on the series of books, especially Every Man's Battle, Every Young Man's Battle, and an entire universe of other battle books having to do with the fight of especially young people against lust. One of the co-authors of that book is a well-known figure among evangelicals, Stephen Arterburn. Walter Kern is the author of this article. Kern is kind of wacky himself. He is the author of the novel Thumbsucker, which is soon to come out as a film, and also of other stuff that's going on out there. He's a regular writer you see in magazines like this, but listen to what he says about his meeting with Stephen Arterburn. You just need to hear this. He said, "As my meeting with Arterburn is winding down, I notice a photo on the desk of a fresh-faced blonde knockout I take to be his daughter. He corrects this impression. She's his third wife, Misty. She's in her early 30s, he informs me. He met her a few years back at one of his seminars. They corresponded through email for a while, and he's been married to her for 9 months. She's also pregnant with their first child. Way to go, dude, I want to tell him, profoundly impressed by this preacher of chaste thinking, who's also managed to land what seems to be a veritable harem's worth of luscious ladies. But first I feel obliged to ask him what happened to his second wife, the one he spoke of, having to fess up to after the car wreck brought on by his ogling. The answer is that they divorced after 20 years of marriage, 20 difficult years, he says. He tells me that in the wake of the divorce 4 years ago when he was 49, he feared that his sheep would realize that their shepherd was pretty seriously lost himself and would wander off to find a new one or perhaps resolve to live without one. But Arterburn's followers stood by their man. To reward them, he says, the least he could do was to practice what he'd been preaching all those years and, for the very first time in his life, quote, walk into a new marriage without having sex first, end quote. Considering young Misty's ultra-foxiness, I'm reading from this article, I suspect this was a challenge even for Arterburn. I ask if he kept the platonic courtship brief. He admits that he did, an honest man, not to mention a lucky dog. Thanks to his candor, my views on abstinence are moderating, I realize. Balancing the eyes and keeping, I can't read the next part, may not be such a terrible hardship after all, as long as a guy has Misty waiting for him in a city like Laguna Beach and the battle doesn't last too long. Now, why did I read that? Because here you have an outsider to evangelicalism, someone who, by the way, looks at the evangelical subculture. He calls us an entire parallel universe. And he sees, well, that the whole issue of sexual abstinence and a concentration on marriage is being, well, at least we could say slightly compromised and complicated by the fact that this man that's written this series of books is actually on his third wife. What does this say about us? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Do we take divorce seriously? Is there a point when the secular left and maybe even the religious left looks to us and says, look, you're getting all hot and bothered about same-sex marriage, but you're really not all that concerned about marriage. Otherwise, you would have to be far more concerned about divorce. What does this say about our local churches? What does it say about our evangelical celebrity circuit? do we really think that marriage is something that is objectively to be defended, objectively to be defined? And do we understand divorce as something that is an abomination in God's sight? It's not the unforgivable sin. Homosexuality is not the unforgivable sin. But we still have to name it for what it is. We have to deal with it for what it is. And we have to uphold marriage among heterosexuals, even as we're talking to homosexuals about why same-sex marriage isn't marriage. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with your calls. I guess I've kind of tipped my hand toward which side of the argument I take here. I do believe that we as evangelicals have a lot of explaining to do, and worse than that, we have a lot of recovery to make. Because on the divorce issue, I think we really are all over the place in a lot of bad places, with far too much acceptance of divorce and far too much embracing of the divorce culture. It's just a way to deal with marital strife and all the rest. The culture of personal autonomy tells us it's all about us, and we're living and breathing and swimming in that water and that atmosphere, and that's telling us it's all about our happiness. That's just not the vision of marriage you're going to find in the Bible. Let's go to Laterra, calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Go ahead, Laterra.
Yes, it's good to talk to you. I have a question for you about where do you think we should start with this problem? A couple of weeks ago, my church was going to a conference, and when I looked at the paraphernalia for the conference, I realized that one of their keynote speakers was a person who used to be a fairly well-known speaker, but divorced from his wife. Supposedly, they had just grown apart or something to that effect and had just amicably decided to divorce. Now, one of the prominent pastors in our city had said that he was friends with this man, but that man would not be allowed to come to his church again to teach or preach. But I've never heard anyone else take such a stance. I decided I wasn't going because I just felt uncomfortable. I felt if he could compromise that way, he might compromise what he was teaching or preaching. But when I said that, you could hear silence with the people that I was talking to. And, of course, everyone else went anyway. And so yeah. I was the only one really taking a stand on that one.
Well, Laterra, hang on here with me for a moment. And, you know, what you said about that pastor really intrigues me. The pastor who said, look, he's a friend, but he can't teach in my church after this. I think that's where one takes a principled stand. And I'm with him insofar as I understand this scenario, and with you in order to say, look, there is a very clear biblical issue here. 1 Timothy 3 says that one who should teach, one who will be recognized by the church and elected to this position of teaching authority, one who will be a pastor, bishop, elder of the church, is one, and you could say a bishop as well, of the local church. This is a man who is to be beyond repute, disrepute. He is to be a man of good repute, and he is to be the husband of one wife. Now, I won't deny that that is a difficult verse to translate, but it simply can't mean that it will be someone who would be serially married, one after the other. And especially when, in the situation you just described, Laterra, this is a couple that just said they grew apart. That just sounds to me like an absolute denial of our responsibility in being married. Laterra, let me just ask you, in your local church, do you think that divorce is taken seriously enough?
Oh, absolutely not. In my local church and in other denominations that I know of around and through the country, people will divorce at the drop of a dime. And, you know, if you say something, you're the devil.
Yeah, because you're being judgmental. Yeah, I appreciate that, Laterra. Great call, and I appreciate the fact that you're struggling with this issue and trying to find the right way to maintain what you understand to be the requirements of Scripture concerning marriage. Let's go to Camille calling from Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Camille.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad you called.
Good. Well, I think that Christians are starting to become like the world in which it's like a microwave effect. You know, we want it to be fixed right now, and if it's not, throw it away and get another one. And that's not how God made marriage. You know, we have something else behind us, and that's God. And we have to get down on our knees, ask the Lord to help us with our marriages, and continue on. In the Bible, it says, men love your wives as God has loved the church. And where has that gone?
Oh, I love it when listeners of this program go to the scripture. And Camille, God bless you for that. And let's just remember that also in the Bible, God is, he reveals himself as the covenant-making and the covenant-keeping God. He makes covenants with his people, and he keeps them. And time and time again, Israel's disobedience is discussed in terms of prostitution and adultery. And the one thing, by the way, that even in the midst of that, God does not contemplate is divorce. I want us to think about that. God says, I will keep covenant with Israel, even when Israel is not keeping covenant with me. That is so countercultural, so counterintuitive to our contemporary day when people say, look, I think I have my own satisfying justification for getting out of this marriage. I just don't want to deal with it anymore. I'm walking out. That simply is not an acceptable biblical response. Thanks for your call, Camille. Let's go to Michelle calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What you just said was very profound. Thank you. I had a quick comment and then a question.
Go right ahead.
I am a child of many divorces. My father's on his fourth. My mother's on her third. Many stepfamilies ripped apart. So I'm very sensitive to the issue. But my question is the sin the divorce or remarriage?
That is a great question. And, Michelle, I would say yes and yes. In other words, divorce itself is a sin. As a matter of fact, divorce is described in Scripture as an abomination. It's one of the strongest words used of sin in the Bible. And you're really looking at homosexuality and adultery and divorce as being some of those things that God is described as hating, not only sin in general, but some sins in particular, because of the unique way in which these sins deny his own glory and lie about God's own character as the covenant-keeping and covenant-making God. But, you know, Michelle, when you talk about remarriage, that certainly just compounds it. And as a matter of fact, that's what Jesus is saying about a man who puts away his wife and then marries another. He makes of that first wife an adulteress. He treats her like an adulteress and commits adultery, basically. Because, you know, here's another interesting question. When it comes to divorce, it's interesting how many people go to church to get married and then they go to the judge to get divorced. They do not even feel any need to have a scriptural, congregational, church assessment of the situation in which there would have to be a judgment if, based on biblical grounds, there's even justification for the divorce, much less the remarriage. Michelle, it just causes pain, literally, to hear you describe the background that has led you to have such an urgency on this issue. I hope that maybe that will wake up someone to what happens when we buy into this ideal of serial marriages. This one, then that one, then the next one. And as Michelle said, just think of all the stepfamilies and stepchildren. Someone's going to give an answer for that. And one of those who will have to give an answer is the aggregate of the congregation that would allow such a thing to happen without confrontation and loving discipline. The phone number, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back. Just as a matter of cultural analysis, after the vote on Wednesday last night, I just listened to several different cable news programs talking about it. And so many of the people, rather condescendingly and with some sense of even sarcasm, said, look, you know, this is not the issue that's really threatening marriage. It's divorce. It's not same-sex marriage. I read to you the editorial from the Boston Globe yesterday in which the editors are saying, look, same-sex couples aren't out, you know, enriching weapons-grade uranium. They're not blowing people up. What's the big issue? Well, the big issue is that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, period. Same-sex marriage is an oxymoron. But our moral credibility, we're not even talking about our cultural influence or our political leverage. We're just talking about our moral credibility it's really on the line when we say we're really, really upset about the idea of same-sex marriage, but then we accept divorce. Finally, let's go to Jim calling and listening on WFIA in Louisville. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, what I just want to point out is the issue between same-sex marriage and divorce, how easily a divorce has been embraced by the church, is the mentality that our world puts upon us, that we're to be in the world but not of the world. And this world teaches that it is a me mentality, and we're to love our wives the way Christ loved the church, sacrificially. And once we stop doing that, we put ourselves first, and that is the height of sin. That's idolatry.
Well, indeed it is. And, of course, by the way, messing sex and marriage up in the Old Testament is pretty directly tied to paganism. One of the things that was to make Israel stand out from the other nations as God's people, God's chosen people, was the fact that they would maintain their own covenants and promises. They would maintain their own vows. And when that does not happen, not only is there inevitable brokenness and pain and all that's brought into the life of a couple and a family and all those who know them and love them, but something is severed within civilization itself. The novelist Pat Conroy, who wrote Prince of Tides and The Great Santini and so many other novels, a very interesting man. In one of his novels, he uses this line, which I have never forgotten. He said, "In every divorce, there is the demise of a little civilization." That is profoundly true. With every divorce, there is the collapse, the demise of some little civilization, that little civilization of a marital couple, where a household, a family is established. It is no small thing when that little civilization is torn apart. Folks, do we keep our promises or not? Do we honor marriage or not? We better get this straight before we go out in the world and tell them what marriage is and is not. But at the same time, we better go do it. It's never been more necessary. I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.